Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 88. It's Saturday, November 14th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. And I must say, COVID-19 is totally dominating the news, although I will include some non-COVID news at the end of the show. But, wow, I must say, with the epidemic in these last few days and couple weeks, this is the most scared I've been in a long time for a public health issue in this country. I don't scare that easily, but this epidemic is basically out of control virtually everywhere in the U.S. Just yesterday, cracking 185,000 plus infections. And we're not just smashing records. I mean, we are just blowing by previous records. So I want to back up just a little bit because, you know, actually reporting on the numbers today when this is a pre-recorded show, it almost becomes irrelevant after two or three or four or five, 6 days. So I want to back up and just go take it more of a bird's eye view. And really want to ask one question that keeps me up at night is how bad can it get? You know, is there an upper limit actually to this infection? There isn't necessarily anything in biology or physics that would stop, you know, this virus from infecting, you know, 30, even 50% of the population if we don't get our act together. And really, that's an unanswerable question because we are in uncharted territory. We have learned a lot about this virus, but it seems there are a lot of things that we've been faced with that we just do not seem to respond to in a way that might be called learning. Now, the middle of November, flu season is beginning. It's beginning. We're not in the middle of it. It's beginning. And if you're looking at the effects that the flu season and this virus would normally thrive in colder weather when we're going indoors, where you have lower humidity, it's more likely to be aerosolized, you have less circulation, you have low humidity, so people have dried out air nostrils, so they're slightly more likely to be infected. All those kind of things that happen in the winter, why the flu season is in the fall and the winter, that's true. For the middle Midwest and the northern part of the country, we're starting to see winter-like conditions and people are going inside and people are turning on the heat, et cetera, et cetera. But we're seeing this virus rage in areas where winter has far from set in. In fact, areas where winter doesn't really set in at all, basically the southern states. Scary. Okay, big picture. We had really good timing, I think, of when this virus hit, basically at the end of flu season, coming out into spring and to summer, where the natural conditions don't favor it being raging on as much. We really lucked out. Unfortunately, we didn't take full advantage of the cost that we paid with lockdowns and stuff in order to get testing and contact tracing and all that kind of stuff set up. Now I'm afraid we actually have the worst timing available. That is with our lame duck federal administration and Congress, which might very well get the worst of this too little, too late syndrome. The same old, same old. Don't expect Donald Trump and the coronavirus task force to do much, if anything, about this. And with Congress, if we don't have pandemic support for businesses and workers, this will really undercut the ability to do strict restrictions. I did a story a couple shows back about, you know, paying restaurants and bars to close down so they don't have to go out of business, but you don't have to have a pandemic raging on because of the conditions in bars and restaurants. So I've said it before and I'll say it again. My real fear is that there's a sweet, ugly spot in this COVID hell that we may actually hit completely. That's where we get the worst of both worlds, where we will just not do enough to stop this virus. We don't have the social fabric to do it. And we can't save businesses. Plus, the virus itself will shut down businesses. You don't need governments for this virus to shut down businesses, because it'll take out workers, whether it's healthcare workers or restaurant workers or any kind of workers. It'll shut down schools, which is happening across the country even now, before we're in the worst of this. And also, in that whole bad timing thing, while people are feeling very hopeful with vaccines, one or more being available in the not-too-distant future, the reality is that vaccine distribution will likely miss the worst of the winter epidemic. We will be through the bulk of it before vaccines can be distributed to the most vulnerable populations. My best hope on the vaccine front is that we get a vaccine available and we're able to get it early into nursing homes. Of course, we need to get it to healthcare workers too, but the nursing homes is really where you've got old, frail people all in one place, and we're seeing those rates skyrocket in particularly the places that are getting hit the worst. But it's just, I mean, it's like a sea of coronavirus. That's pretty much a tide that's taken over the whole country. Okay, well, again, I wanted to back up a little bit and just talk about, you know, the responses that we have to effectively stop and beat back this pandemic is a series of layers. There are no silver bullets. We need to layer a whole bunch of things on top of one another. Things like mask wearing and social distancing and community restrictions, testing, contact tracing, hospital capacity. These layers, we have not actually made any of them particularly strong. We have real issues with all of those. And yet, each of those layers is coming under even more attack. Mask wearing, of course, has been a politically charged thing for whatever reason for a long time. And that does not seem to be ending, even in the face of communities that are very hard hit. Oddly enough, those counties that were the hardest hit were actually more likely to vote for Donald Trump. And of course, people are scared of businesses closing too. But again, I want to reemphasize that it is a false dichotomy to say you either need to support coronavirus prevention or you need to support businesses. We cannot do one without the other. If we do not stop this pandemic from raging through our communities, the virus will shut down businesses without our consent. Okay. Social distancing. That's another one, of course, that has to get integrated across a lot of fronts. But I wanted to touch on just a couple articles that kind of catch the flavor of what we're facing here. First, very quickly, this is from our very own Ohio State University from Science Daily. Americans likely to attend large holiday gatherings despite COVID-19 survey finds. A new national survey by the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center finds that although a majority of Americans plan to take precautions at holiday gatherings, such as social distancing and asking those with COVID symptoms not to attend, many will also put themselves at risk. Nearly 2 in 5 report they will likely attend a gathering with more than 10 people, and a third will not ask guests to wear masks. So that's another part of that perfect storm in this lame duck period that we have. And Sure enough, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department has reported that the recent surge we're experiencing is linked to Halloween gatherings. Now, if you think Halloween was a time for gatherings, just meditate upon Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. This is a perfect storm. Okay, well, to catch the flavor of all of that too, let's look at this article from Associated Press. Surging virus cases get a shrug in many Midwestern towns. Danny Rice had a good sense of how dangerous the coronavirus can be. What puzzles him are the people who have curtailed so much of their lives to avoid being infected by the virus. I'm not going out and looking to catch it, he said, sitting at a cluttered desk in his auto repair shop in the teeny eastern Nebraska community of Elwood. I don't want to catch it, but if I get it, I get it. That's just how I feel. Plenty of people agree with Rice, and health experts acknowledge those views are powering soaring COVID-19 infection rates, especially in parts of the rural Midwest where the disease is spreading unabated and threatening to overwhelm hospitals. It's not that people in Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, and elsewhere don't realize their states are leading the nation in new cases per capita. It's that many of them aren't especially concerned. Wayne County, home to 6,400 people in southern Iowa, has the state's second highest case rate. Yet its public health administrator, Shelley Bickle, says mask wearing is rare. She finds it particularly appalling when she sees older people who are at high risk shopping at a grocery store without one. I just want to get on the speaker and say, why don't you have your mask on? It's just amazing, Bickle said. Jenna Loves, public health director of Jones County, Iowa, said even now that her rural county has the highest state rate, people have opted not to make any changes, such as protecting themselves and others by wearing masks. They just don't think it's real, she said. They don't think it's going to be that bad, or they just don't want to wear a mask because we've made it a whole political thing at this point. In part, though, some of these views are hard to fight because of the reality that many people have no symptoms, and most of those who do get sick recover quickly. And treatment advances means that those who become seriously ill are less likely to die from the virus than when it first emerged in the spring. Even though cases and the death toll are rising, infectious disease experts note that death rates appear to be falling. Like most people, Jay Stibbe, 52, of Fargo, North Dakota, said he and his family are respectful of COVID-19 protocols and wear masks where required. However, Stibbe said he doesn't see enough, quote, concrete information about the virus to stop him from going about his normal life, even though North Dakota leads the nation in the number of virus cases per capita. And I would add, if that section of the Midwest were a nation, it would be the nation with the highest rate. In fact, it is the center of the pandemic on the planet. Okay, back to the story. We have an 18-year-old and a 60-year-old, and we certainly believe this is an important time of life to maybe shine a little bit, he said. We're trying to create as much normalcy as we can. We try not to live in fear. We've traveled. We go out to dinner. In Plattsmouth, Nebraska, Karen Prohaska, 76, says she doesn't generally wear a mask in her downtown purse and jewelry shop, but will put one on at the request of a customer. When customers come into the store with a face covering, she asks if they'd like her to don one as well. Most say no and ask if it's okay for them to remove theirs. I hope that I don't get the virus, but I've never really been a germaphobe, Prohaska said.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, when it comes to community restrictions, we're seeing sort of the same hodgepodge half measures that we've seen at the various points in the epidemic. We haven't really seemed to learn much from that. It does seem, when you listen to our very own Governor Mike DeWine, that he recognizes how truly scary the situation is. But even today, after he said that if things don't get better, he's going to perhaps shut down bars and restaurants and gyms, I think he thought maybe it was going to get better. And we have just racked up record after record, you know, from 5,000 to 6,000 to 7,000 to 8,000 in just a matter of days. So it's unlikely that that's going to get better by next Wednesday when he says that, you know, he might want to implement these restrictions. And frankly, you know, if he wants to allow some time for businesses to prepare, you know, that's, you know, that makes sense. But if you're going to hold out people, maybe I will, maybe I won't, maybe I will, maybe I won't, and then just do it one day, that does not help businesses plan either. So I suspect that Governor DeWine will probably be forced to do something as emergency conditions emerge, but it's probably going to fall very neatly under the too little, too late category. Okay, well, I have a couple stories that kind of get at that too. Here's one from The Hill. States reimpose extensive COVID-19 restrictions. Three states are set to reimpose some of the most extensive coronavirus-related restrictions amid a nationwide spike of infections and hospitalizations. Oregon Governor Kate Brown, Democrat, announced a 2-week-long freeze that will close certain businesses and dramatically reduce capacity of indoor spaces. Brown's plan, which will begin on Wednesday, will limit all bars and restaurants to takeout only, close all gyms, prohibit indoor and outdoor gatherings to no more than 6 people from 2 different households, cap capacity at grocery stores and pharmacies at 75%, and allow churches and faith groups to accommodate indoor crowds of no more than 25 people inside or 50 people outside. During a press conference, Brown said the freeze will last longer for certain hotspot counties that have been hit harder with the COVID surge. I want to be honest about that now. Be prepared. Our actions right now, no matter where in the state you live, are absolutely critical, Brown said. Brown said the freeze will not apply to barbershops, hair salons, or homeless shelters. Outdoor recreation and sports programs, including Pac-12 college football games, are also exempt, as are child care programs, K-12 schools, and higher education institutions. The announcement came on the same day Brown and fellow West Coast governors in California and Washington issued a joint travel advisory, warning that anyone arriving from out of state should quarantine for 2 weeks. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, Democrat, is going even further. The state is going to hit the, quote, reset button, Lujan Grisham said. From November 16th through November 30th, all non-essential businesses will be closed and residents are being urged to stay at home. Essential businesses such as grocery stores, pharmacies, childcare facilities, and more will be forced to minimize operations and in-staffing personnel to the greatest extent possible, although they may remain open. In Vermont, Governor Phil Scott is one of the lone Republican governors reimposing harsh restrictions. Effective at 10 p.m. on Saturday, the state prohibited multiple household gatherings both inside and outside. All restaurants have to close in-person dining at 10 p.m. and must provide seated dining service to no more than one household per table. All bars, breweries, and social clubs will be closed. All recreational sports programs will be suspended, and out-of-town college students must quarantine upon arrival in the state. Coronavirus cases are rising to record levels across the country. While the virus is known to spread quickly in gyms and indoor restaurants, few governors have taken such drastic steps by closing them down. Okay, and next up, from Stat News, they're not really doing anything. As COVID-19 cases spiral, leaders around the U.S. lose urgency on prevention. More than a dozen states have seen record-high COVID-19 infections in the past days, As the country experiences case counts never seen before anywhere in the world, and once again, surging hospitalizations and deaths. But public health experts around the country told STAT they were deeply worried that there has not been a correspondingly urgent response from federal, state, and local leaders. As a result, they warned, the country is set on an even more dire course as it moves deeper into the fall and holiday season. Even as cases spiral, many state leaders, wary of inflaming a worn-out public, dismissive of the pandemic, or philosophically opposed to government intervention, are not implementing the types of measures that succeeded in reining in major outbreaks in the spring and summer. By and large, public leaders, some Democrats, but particularly Republicans, are putting the impetus on individuals to take steps to slow transmission instead of spearheading new campaigns to curtail the coronavirus. Some governors and other elected officials say the public is tired of burdensome interventions. Leaders also feel burned by the backlash to more intensive measures or believe the virus will spread no matter what, so restrictions that harm the economy and society aren't worth the cost. The results, experts say, is a dangerous combination of fatigue, fatalism, and forfeiture that will only result in more illnesses, hospitalizations, and deaths. Cautious individual behavior, the type that governors and other leaders have been so focused on, is an incredibly powerful tool against the pandemic. If people wear masks, keep their distance from others, wash their hands, and stay home when they're sick or might have been exposed to the virus, it can have a major effect on overall transmission. Health authorities say they are preaching responsible individual behavior in part because significant transmission is occurring among households and at gatherings of family and friends. This type of messaging is crucial, experts say. But experts worry that simply relying on people to do the right thing might not be enough. Even people who have done their best to comply are slipping a bit and are doing certain activities, indoor dinner parties with friends, for example, they wouldn't have done a few months ago. In addition, President Trump and other leaders who have downplayed or dismissed the virus have undermined efforts to motivate people to act responsibly, posing a threat to everyone else. Especially with the Trump aspect, you have from the top that this is not a disease to be feared, that masks aren't effective, and that this is a hoax. And of course, getting sick himself and seemingly getting over pretty quickly, I think this has reinforced the idea that this isn't a virus to be feared and that we have to keep going on with our lives, said Tara Smith, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Kent State University in Ohio. In Smith State, Governor Mike DeWine received praise for his early handling of the pandemic, but has since been hesitant to institute new strategies, even as cases rise. What's particularly frustrating to public health experts is that time matters when it comes to how effective a given intervention will be at slowing the spread of the virus. With infections growing exponentially, a strategy that can help corral cases one day might only make a dent if instituted later on. Waiting a week to strike can mean the difference between it being sufficient or not, between people staying alive or dying. Experts also stress that the range of interventions available has been falsely perceived as a binary of lockdown or nothing. Rather, they say, it's more of a spectrum. Targeted closures or certain restrictions that prevent crowding can have an impact before the virus gets so out of control and hospitals get so overwhelmed that stay-at-home orders are issued. More than a dozen states don't have mask mandates, though some cities and counties in those places do. Other measures like widespread testing can also have an impact. This summer, for example, Texas and Arizona paused certain parts of their reopening, shuttered bars, allowed for mask mandates, and reduced indoor dining capacities, helping rechart the trajectories of their outbreaks. Experts say these layered approaches, with interventions like masks, closing high-risk businesses, and deterring people from gathering, each chipping in some amount of benefit, can turn perilous situations around. Social distancing policy is not an on-off switch. This is a dial that needs to be calibrated to the temperature, said Thomas Tsai, a health policy expert at Harvard School of Public Health. And in a lot of these places, these are hot spots, and we may have to reinstitute more localized or focused physical distancing, such as bans on indoor dining. In states where the virus is raging, however, there seems to be little appetite for those measures. One reason is because Congress and the Trump administration have failed to approve new sources of aid to businesses and workers for months, making it all the less likely that governors and mayors would be willing or able to shut down restaurants, gyms, theaters, and bars. But experts worry that political leaders could be painting themselves into a corner. Options dwindle as transmission picks up. If no action is taken, the situation will eventually get so bad that their only choice may be to reimpose some type of lockdown in order to stop a deluge of patients from collapsing hospitals. It's thinking about using a sharper or finely tuned instrument as opposed to a larger, blunter tool, Sai said. But you have to use those sharper instruments in the right window of opportunity. No one wants another lockdown. They are incredibly damaging economically, culturally, socially, educationally, and to people's health. But if there has to be a second round of them in some places, experts say there are smarter ways to institute them, based on the knowledge now of where the virus spreads most prolifically and how to minimize the collateral damage. European countries that have re-entered some form of shutdown have exempted schools. Health systems are adapting to encourage people to keep up with cancer screenings instead of canceling appointments en masse. The idea is now, from what we know, create more efficient and evidence-based types of lockdown, said Anna Bento, a disease ecologist at Indiana University. In different cities and in different states, these lockdowns may look very different from each other, depending on the level of transmission and if a certain type of activity, such as a sporting event, is driving the spread in a given region, for example. There are some local and state officials who are acting now to try to stave off more disruptive measures. Illinois shut down indoor dining once again. Some restaurants have in turn sued. In Texas, El Paso County is in the middle of a two-week closure of non-essential businesses, though some businesses in the state have tried to have the order overturned. Oregon has asked people in some counties to pause gatherings and businesses to limit capacities. Other states have lowered maximum capacities for gatherings, and another approach, Denver and Massachusetts, have announced earlier closing times for non-essential businesses. Some experts have questioned the impact of limited hours for indoor dining, given that it still allows the underlying risky activity of eating inside. The virus doesn't care if it's 8 p.m. or 10 p.m. last call. But others have said such a strategy could have some impact, given that it limits the hours people can be around each other. Plus, the later people are out, which often corresponds to how much they are drinking, the sloppier their precautionary behavior gets. As for more substantive measures, there is no real momentum for leaders at the state and local level to act in many cases. Political leaders take action when there's popular support for them, and it's led by demands among their constituents or if there's a top-down pressure or support for these policies, like the White House trying to rally governors to act, said Zoe McLaren, a health policy expert at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. What we're seeing in the U.S. right now is a lack of pressure on both of those fronts. People are understandably tired of COVID-19 precautions, and in many cases worry that the economic and social damage inflicted by the country's failure to control the virus will only get worse with more restrictions. And the Trump administration has largely washed its hands of trying to stem the spread of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes COVID-19. President-elect Biden has proclaimed that tackling COVID-19 will be among his top priorities, but experts fear the place the country will be in when Biden assumes the presidency on January 20th. Cases are already surging as dropping temperatures push more people indoors and propel viral transmission, and as people are expected to travel and get together for the holidays. This can be hard to do for 9 months, Pradesh Tosh, an infectious disease physician and medical director for emergency management at the Mayo Clinic, said about the precautions we've all been asked to make. And now we're coming up on holidays and people coming back from college and people wanting to have gatherings with their families. These are decisions that people have to make. Is it safe to bring an 80-year-old with multiple comorbidities into your home? Public health experts say they're regularly asked when current outbreaks will peak or just how cases could go. This is not predetermined, they stress. With so many susceptible people out there, the virus will continue to circulate if it's allowed to. Cases will keep rising unless behavior and policy change. This is a virus that just truly does not care about borders. It doesn't care about elections. It doesn't care about politics, said Harvard epidemiologist Michael Minna. It's not even alive. A virus is like a little robot that hijacks people's cells. It doesn't care about any of that stuff. It will just spread. And of course, one thing mentioned in this article is the return of college students. We had a mass migration of students from various communities all around the country to other communities, college campuses. Now we're going to see the return of those people who went to college campuses back to the home. That is a very difficult thing and hard to do safely. Okay, well, another set of layers that need to be in place in order to get some control of this virus is testing and contact tracing. So let's get a little bit about what's happening here from Toledo's own WTVG, COVID tests in short supply. If you have the telltale symptoms of COVID, one of ProMedica's top doctors says you should stay home even if you can't get a test to confirm you have the disease. That rationale is because COVID tests are suddenly in short supply. It's not surprising to me that as a community, we're seeing a shortage of testing just because of the amount of disease that we see, explains Dr. Brian Kaminsky, Vice President of Quality and Safety at ProMedica and Medical Director of the Emergency Department at ProMedica Flower Hospital. In fact, if you show signs such as a fever, cough, chills, muscle and body aches, loss of taste and smell, and any gastrointestinal distress, Dr. Kaminsky says, you more than likely don't have the flu, since the influenza season has yet to begin in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. Your odds of having coronavirus are much higher. And of course, when testing gets backed up and there's delays in people getting results, and people are going around doing their business while they're waiting results, it makes contact tracing less and less effective. At the point we are locally, it's doubtful that we've got even a fraction of the effectiveness per case that we had a month ago. Okay, well, here's a very interesting article talking about the need for actually more testing, surveillance, widespread surveillance testing, where you're testing asymptomatic people, regular populations, in order to get control of the virus. So why don't we look at an area where there are very likely easily to be controlled environments and what happens? This from Science Daily. Results suggest the need for widespread surveillance testing to reduce COVID-19 transmission in group settings. A study of nearly 2,000 Marine recruits who went through supervised quarantine before starting basic training revealed several instances of asymptomatic transmission of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, despite the quarantine measures. The findings have important implications for the effectiveness of public health measures to suppress transmission of COVID-19 among young adults, whether in military training, schools, or other aspects of the pandemic. The researchers from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and the Naval Medical Research Center studied new Marine recruits while they were in a two-week supervised quarantine. The study results, published November 11th in the New England Journal of Medicine, showed that few infected recruits had symptoms before diagnosis of SARS-CoV-2 infection. That transmission occurred despite implementing many best practice public health measures, and that diagnoses were made only by scheduled tests, not by tests performed in response to symptoms. The study data revealed asymptomatic spread of the virus even under strict military orders for quarantine and public health measures that most likely experienced better compliance than what would be possible in other youth settings like college campuses. The researchers noted that daily temperature and symptom checks did not detect infections among the recruits, and that the virus was largely transmitted within a given platoon group where trainees tended to be near one another. The study focused on 1,848 study participants who enrolled from nine different Marine recruit classes, each containing 350 to 450 recruits, between May 15th and the end of July. The participants were offered enrollment in a prospective longitudinal study after self-quarantine at home for 2 weeks prior to arrival at basic training. Once they arrived, they were required to follow strict group quarantine measures with two-person rooms for 2 weeks, the duration of the study period, before the start of the actual training. The supervised group quarantine took place at a college used only for that purpose. Each recruit class was housed in a different building and had different dining times and training schedules, so the classes did not interact. Each weekly class was further divided into platoons of 50 to 60 people. During the study period, all recruits wore cloth masks, practiced social distancing of at least 6 feet, and regularly washed their hands. And each recruit had just one roommate. Most of their instruction, including exercising and learning military customs and traditions, was done outdoors. After each class finished quarantine, a deep cleaning using bleach on surfaces occurred in all rooms and common areas of the dormitories before the arrival of the next class. The identification of six independent transmission clusters, defined by distinct mutations, indicates that there are multiple independent SARS-CoV-2 introductions and outbreaks during the supervised quarantine, said Harm Van Bakkel, assistant professor of genetics and genomics sciences at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. The data from this large study indicates that in order to curtail coronavirus transmission in group settings to prevent spillover to the wider community, we need to establish widespread initial and repeated surveillance testing of all individuals regardless of symptoms. This study, particularly in conjunction with the fact that now it's hard, or even harder, to get testing in the community, is just points to a chronic major fail of our response in virtually all communities across the country to this, is that people should be tested regularly. you know, large institutions, workers, people should be allowed, and it shouldn't be just based on symptoms, because even in these very controlled environments, like these military recruits in a quarantine, that they should be able to, you know, if you can't control the virus under those conditions, then obviously waiting to do testing only when there are symptoms is that much more dangerous. Okay, well, the last layer of pandemic prevention that I want to talk about is hospital capacity. And of course, we're hearing that being maxed out in various parts in the country, and that train is coming down the road. And I heard a very interesting way for her to talk about this. They talked about the three S's: staff, space, and stuff. So you need all three of these things for hospital capacity to function properly, and you're missing any one of those, you're in trouble. And it seems that staff shortages is typically what the bottleneck is in care in these hospital systems run to capacity. It's either because we have staffing shortage right from the get-go, even pre-pandemic, and also the pandemic itself infects healthcare workers that need to take time off. Unless, of course, you're in North Dakota where they're telling nurses to work with COVID infections if they're asymptomatic. So staff, space, and stuff. Space, it's usually easier. You can expand ICU by doubling up beds in the unit or taking over other units to be intensive care units. But of course, if you don't have the staff, then you got a problem. Now, the stuff would be equipment, breathing machines, that type of thing, personal protective equipment, and therapeutics. This can also be a limiting thing. There has been various shortages of personal protective equipment that have continued to this day and are, of course, going to get worse as we need more. This is another grand failure. President Trump should have run the Defense Production Act to produce so much PPE that was coming out of our ears. In fact, I think it's kind of ridiculous that the regular citizens don't have availability to N95 masks if they want them. You might as well have the state of the art. The darn things cost $1 a piece to produce. Come on, we shouldn't have to be, you know, even having to re-clean these things rather than, we should just have them coming out of our ears. That's the truth. And I've talked on the show before too about supply issues with all kinds of therapeutics, not just COVID-19 direct therapeutics, but any kind of supportive care that needs in a hospital. As you get a pandemic, which is a worldwide epidemic, it creates shortages in this country and from supplies and therapeutics that need to come from other countries and supply chains. Okay, well, what this really brings us to, which is not quite an unknown, but to the degree that the death rate changes as we see cases spike, is a frightening prospect. Now, many researchers have shown that there has been a decline in the death rate of about 30% from the first wave to the second wave or so over the summer. And this is age adjusted. And some of that has to do with just, you know, some with therapeutics, but also just learning techniques. Like, we actually learned that ventilators actually may cause more harm than good. So you have to be very careful about putting somebody on a ventilator. And rather than being some great thing, it's actually really definitely a last resort. But the question is, are we going to continue to see a death rate that's less than what we saw earlier in the pandemic, or are we actually going to see a spike in deaths? Now, we know with staffing shortages, you have people waiting in emergency rooms, you have people that have moderate or even severe symptoms are actually be told to go home and wait at home and told, well, look for this, look for that. If it get worse, come back. And as we know, this virus can change very swiftly. You can be feeling fairly well 1 hour and a couple hours later need an ICU. So having somebody waiting at home, particularly in a rural area where you're not necessarily near a hospital, is particularly dangerous. And like I said, with supply shortages, that's only going to get worse. I expect that the death rate will start to spike and way more than to compensate for that 30% reduction that we've had up to this point, that you'll probably see death rates higher than even in the spring as hospital capacity and the healthcare system gets overwhelmed. Okay, I want to close with just one focus that I think is something that really is going to drive this COVID hell disaster that's coming down the tracks here. And that is the urban-rural divide. The things I talked about, particularly with attitudes and practices around mask wearing and social distancing and gatherings together among friends and family. This is huge between the urban and rural areas. And as we know in public health, the risk for infection and available healthcare capacity, they're not evenly distributed like many things in public health. You often have like 20% of the population that has 80% of the risk for a variety of reasons. Well, this is kind of the situation we're in with the urban-rural divide. You're seeing that you actually have the risks that have to deal with greater chance of infection, you know, mask wearing, social distancing, what the epidemiologists like to call loosey-goosey, is more likely to happen in these rural areas. Also, you have older and less healthy populations, so when they get sick, they get sicker, and you have less healthcare capacity. If you can get there, it's harder to get there, too. You add all those layers together, and I expect that the rural death rates, both because they have a higher infection rate and poorer healthcare capacity, is going to lead to much increased death rates for those folks, unfortunately, that are in the rural areas. Okay, well, that's kind of the broad trajectory there. Let's drill down a little bit and look at Lucas County. Wow, yesterday was another one of these shocking, jaw-dropping, record-breaking days. Our average daily cases for the last 7 days yesterday hit 200 plus. This average daily cases over the previous week has doubled in the last 10 days. And this over 200 average is almost double what the previous weekly high we've ever had past an epidemic, which was the last wave locally. It hit 114 as an average. And this is just skyrocketing. Now, we have an interesting thing with positivity rates. I've been reporting on this, and I put in a call with the Toledo Lucas County Health Department epidemiologist, but I haven't heard back yet. The way they've been reporting tests has been kind of irregular, so I've been a little reluctant about how to interpret the positivity rate. Now, the most recent week, they actually cited in a press release from the Toledo Lucas County Health Department that the positivity rate was 12%. We've been testing maybe something on the average of around 500 people a day in recent weeks. Well, in the last week, we have 12,123 tests that were reported. But that includes a dump on one day of 9,000 test results. Basically, weeks worth of results dropped in one day. So if you include all of those test results, which are probably an accumulation from perhaps several weeks before, maybe even more, and you take the 1,449 positives that we had in the 7 days, we come up with a 12% positivity rate. But there's an interesting statistical thing that definitely highlights the reporting of tests and the reporting of positive tests. Yesterday, in the press release, the daily press release on the COVID-19 stats, it showed that we had 378 positives, smashing the previous record. Just, I mean, wow. But the odd thing is, while they reported 378 positives, which is 378 positive tests, 378 positive people, they only reported an additional 291 tests. So, of course, that's actually physically impossible, but it just shows that the syncing up of the number of tests being reported and the number of positives is not synced up well. So I suspect that 9,000 test dump is actually represents tests that were performed more than a week before, and I suspect that our positivity is well above 12%. But let's just say, at an absolute minimum, our positivity rate is 12%. our positivity rate has tended to be quite a bit higher than at the state, and the state right now for the 7-day rate is 11.8%, about that 12%, and it's creeped up even over that in recent days, even though we've had record numbers of tests in the state. And again, as I've reported before, the amount of testing done in Lucas County is at a lower rate than testing done in Ohio, and the testing done in Ohio is at a lower rate than testing in the nation as a whole. So we have a testing shortage. Okay, well, let's look at that most vulnerable population, nursing homes. Well, the good news is the number of active cases didn't go up. It went from 107 to 93. Woohoo! That's 33 residents and 60 staff. And with that many staff cases, the ratio of more than twice as many staff as residents is perhaps some good news amidst that outbreak, that are preventing widespread outbreaks from staff to residents. But either way, this is at levels that are unprecedented since the reporting was required after about a month and a half or two of the pandemic. And the thing that shows that this getting out of control in the long-term care facilities, the nursing homes, is the positivity this week went up to 9.9%. And that's up from 6.7% before, and is like triple from like 5 weeks ago when it was 3.3%. But the thing that's especially scary about this 9.9% positivity rate in our long-term care facilities is that this is actually one of the places in the U.S., and we've actually had a federal response to try to get testing. So it's one of the more regularly tested populations in the U.S., and, of course, our most vulnerable population, where about 1% of the people in this country are in long-term care facilities, and it was and 40% of the deaths overall in the U.S. have come from long-term care facilities. So very vulnerable population. So this notion, again, that we can somehow, you know, sequester off this population from high rates of community transmission is just not true. And apparently, we cannot even keep testing capacity up enough to get under that 5% positivity testing that would indicate some level of decent testing. Okay, well, a little bit better news, I suppose. Well, good and bad. Okay, let's look at University of Toledo. Given the fact that the cases in the community have skyrocketed, the good news is that UT, it hasn't increased quite as quickly, but it has gone from 20 the previous week to 53 the last week. And the surveillance testing, sort of at random in the UT community, was about a 2% positivity, which is about what it's ran recently. So I would expect, actually, that we would see an increase with the way it's raging on in the community, but it doesn't look like UT is doing, on grading on a curve, really any worse than the larger community as a whole, which ain't saying much. Now, we've got a similar thing going on with the Lucas County schools. You know, the prior week, we had 47 staff and 53 students with identified infections, but again, there's no regular standard protocol for testing in that population. Kind of willy-nilly. But that 47 staff and 53 students had moved up in the most recent week to 61 staff and 50 students. So the students stayed relatively even, but the staff has increased, which you might very well expect on either case for staff or students, that if you have cases rising in a community, that even if they're not, may not be getting it in the school community, that they can just as well get it in other community settings. Okay, well, that does it for our local drill down. Now I'd like to step back a little bit and look at one of the dividing lines in this epidemic that we've looked at much before, but not in this show yet. When I was talking earlier about the layers, I talked about the rural and urban, which I do think is a profound divide. But I want to get back to the issue of inequities amongst people of color. Okay, this from Stat News. Health experts want to prioritize people of color for a COVID-19 vaccine, but how should it be done? As the U.S. edges closer to approving a vaccine for COVID-19, a difficult decision is emerging as a central issue. Should people in hard-hit communities of color receive priority access to it? And if so, how should that be done? Frontline health workers, elderly people, and those with chronic conditions that make them especially vulnerable to COVID-19 are likely to be at the head of the line. But there's also support among public health experts for making special efforts to deliver the vaccine early on to Black, Latino, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander, and Native American people who have experienced higher rates of serious illness and death from the coronavirus. Having a racial preference for COVID-19 vaccine is not only ethically permissible, but I think it's an ethical imperative, says Lawrence Gostin, a professor of global health law at the Georgetown University. The reason is both because of historical structural racism that's resulted in grossly unequal health outcomes for all kinds of diseases, and because COVID-19 has so disproportionately impacted the lives of people of color. There are concerns, however, about legal objections to any framework that uses race and ethnicity when determining vaccine allocation and the way it might be interpreted in court. For instance, judicial scrutiny would not allow healthcare workers to skip a white person in line for a vaccine in favor of a person of color, as Gostin wrote recently in a Journal of American Medical Association. He also noted that legally, a public health agency could probably not distribute vaccines to geographic locations based solely on race. My worry is that if there was explicitly racial priority given to the COVID-19 vaccine, we could be embroiled in litigation that would really undermine implementation of the vaccine process, and also be a great risk of being overturned by a Supreme Court, particularly with its new conservative majority, Gostin told Stat. There's also concern that some groups, especially Black people, might be hesitant to be among the first to get a vaccine, given the history of mistreatment of Black patients in medical research. Yeah, amen to that. The other challenge you have with saying we want African Americans to step up first is that we don't want people to feel they're being guinea pigs, said Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association, which I'll editorially note is a Black man. We need to be very careful. We don't want to give people the perception that they're being experimented upon. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which gives vaccination guidance to the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, won't make a decision on who should get a vaccine and whether to give preference to community of color until a vaccine is approved. The group will be guided in part by a framework released last month by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, which advocates taking an equitable approach to vaccine allocation. The National Academy's recommendations are broken down into four phases and set a goal to ensure that every step of the process takes into account the disproportionate public health and economic impact the virus has had on the elderly and communities of color. We're making sure that we're prioritizing those communities who have borne the largest burden of the pandemic, said Helene Gale, president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust and co-chair of the National Academy's report. Across all phases, the National Academy says geographic priority should be given to communities that are high on what the CDC calls the Social Vulnerability Index, which identifies communities most endangered and in need of aid during disasters like hurricanes. The index takes into account poverty, unemployment, and health insurance rates, among other socioeconomic, demographic, housing, and transportation vulnerabilities. We wanted to make sure that there was real consideration given to getting it to people who are at the highest risk, particularly community of colors, who oftentimes are higher on the social vulnerability scale, said Gale. The first phase outlined by the National Academies would include frontline health workers like those at hospitals or nursing homes and first responders who are at high risk of contracting the virus. Vaccination of these workers would also allow them to continue providing essential care, especially to the elderly who are at the greatest risk of contracting or dying from COVID-19. Nursing homes have seen 63,600 deaths among their residents, more than one-fourth of the U.S. deaths according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and some 800 nursing home staff have died from COVID-19, according to the report. An equity lens has to make sure even those categories that were focused on the type of workers that oftentimes are neglected and fall through the cracks in our system, said Kirsten Bibbins Domingo, an epidemiologist at the University of California, San Francisco, who is a reviewer for the report. Those workers are disproportionately low-wage workers. They're disproportionately workers from communities of color. Bibbins Domingo said taking an equitable approach to the first phase would mean making sure it's not just doctors who receive the vaccine. It's the healthcare worker, the public health aide, the home health aide who's going to come in and take care of my mother and then go to work in a nursing home and then go to work somewhere else who I worry about won't get prioritized for the vaccination and absolutely should be, she said. The report said 28% of nursing home workers are black, while among health aides, 30% are black and 18% are Latino. But she said it would be a challenge to ensure equitable distribution. It will be up to state, local, and tribal health agencies to determine who falls into each priority group and how to deliver it to them. It's likely going to be enforced through the way we distribute vaccinations to healthcare organizations to give to their employees, said Bibbins Domingo. And the question will be whether those low-wage healthcare workers and contracted employees will actually get the vaccinations they need. The CDC issued a revised version of its COVID-19 vaccination playbook in October, which was influenced by the National Academies report and designed to help states, territories, and local health officials develop plans for distributing vaccines. The playbook suggests jurisdictions make plans that ensure equitable access to vaccination and lists underrepresented racial and ethnic groups as critical populations that may be at an increased risk of acquiring COVID-19. But Howard Koh, a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and a former Assistant Secretary of Health and Department of Health and Human Services during the Obama administration, noted that the National Academy's guidelines were just that, guidelines. Once all that advice and insight and analysis is put into it, it's ultimately up to government officials to lead and coordinate the distribution. He pointed out that national guidelines and principles aren't necessarily followed through at the state and local level, pointing to what happened following the shutdown in the spring. Every state reopened by using its own standards. Even though the CDC put out some guidelines, they weren't enforced and no one was held accountable. Another challenge is that some of the vaccines require being held in extreme cold conditions, including the Pfizer one that's likely to be first approved and needs to be kept at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. That would limit where they can be stored and what communities, such as Native American populations in rural areas, have access to them. While the National Academies panel prioritized people at risk, Benjamin cautioned that its plan could be misunderstood if the public messaging isn't correct. If we only say we want to go to this zip code or that zip code or communities of color without doing it on risk, then you run the risk of stigmatizing those populations and giving people a vaccine that don't need them, he said. If you're healthy, just the fact you're African American doesn't mean that you ought to get to the front of the line, Benjamin said. If you're African American and you're a bus driver and you have a chronic disease, absolutely. Okay, running out of time here. It's not going to be able to get to much non-COVID stuff. Let's do two quick stories to close the show. This from The Hill, CDC, proportion of pediatric emergency room visits for mental health increased sharply amid pandemic. The CDC data found mental health-related emergency room visits increased 31% for children between the ages of 12 and 17 from March to October compared to the same period in 2019. There was also a 24% increase in emergency room visits for children between ages 5 and 11. Researchers note that reduced access to institutions like schools and community clinics may have left parents and children increasingly reliant on emergency rooms for those services. And in a more general but related story, this from Science Daily, suicide rates increased during hurricanes, tornadoes, and other similar events. Disasters like hurricanes and tornadoes are occurring with increasing frequency and severity across the globe. In addition to impacting local communities, infrastructure, and economy, these disasters also lead to severe emotional distress and anxiety for those living in their paths. A team of researchers, including the University of Delaware's Jennifer Horney, founding director of the epidemiology program at the College of Health Sciences, examined the impact of 281 natural disasters on suicide rates during a 12-year span. She and others looked at disaster declaration data and found overall suicide rates increased by 23% when compared to rates before and after the disaster. Suicide rates increased for all types of disasters, including severe storms, floods, hurricanes, and ice storms, with the largest overall increase occurring 2 years after a disaster, according to a published article in the Journal of Crisis Intervention and Suicide Prevention. And of course, this pandemic counts as a disaster. Well, that does it for the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, or you can queue up future shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.